Radio Prague News.
The Czech foreign minister has slammed Russia over the Sea of Azov incident. President Zeman, who is on an official visit to Israel, is to address the Knesset. And the prime minister has been questioned by the police over his son's alleged abduction. Czech Foreign Minister Tomáš Petříček has said he is greatly disturbed by developments off the Crimean Peninsula, where Russia fired on and seized three Ukrainian naval vessels in a major escalation of tensions between the two countries. Russia accused the Ukrainian ships of illegally entering its waters after blocking the Kerch Strait, the only access to the Sea of Azov, which is shared between the two countries. Minister Petříček said in a tweet on Monday that Russian appropriation of the Sea of Azov was as bad as its annexation of Crimea. The Czech foreign minister said he expected a joint EU statement on the matter, adding that the Czech Republic would be ready to join international sanctions over the incident. On an official visit to Israel, Czech President Miloš Zeman said he was fascinated by President Rivlin's idea of one state with two nations, saying he could not envisage an independent state in the Gaza Strip since he perceived Hamas as a terrorist organization. President Zeman said the idea of one state with two nations was provocative, but noted that all bold ideas were. President Zeman arrived in Israel on Sunday and is expected to inaugurate the new Czech House Cultural Center in Jerusalem alongside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Monday afternoon, he will address the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. The Czech head of state is accompanied by the Speaker of the Czech Lower House of Parliament, Radek Vondráček, and four cabinet ministers. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš was questioned by the police on Monday in connection with an investigation into his son's alleged abduction to Crimea. According to Czech radio, the Prime Minister spent close to 2 hours at a Prague police station giving testimony with regard to the case. The Prime Minister, who claims there was no abduction, says journalists used his son, who suffers from schizophrenia, to create a slander campaign against him. The opposition called a vote of no confidence over the scandal last Friday, but the Prime Minister's government survived it. In a related development, according to the weekly Euro, investigators working on the Stork's Nest case, in which the Prime Minister is suspected of EU subsidy fraud, say they will need more time to assemble evidence. The investigation is thus unlikely to be concluded by the end of the year. E-sales on Black Friday reached a record 4.2 billion crowns, according to the Association for Electronic Sales. On Friday, e-shops saw a 300% increase in sales as compared to regular days. The annual sales event was so successful this year that ALSA decided to stretch it to a fortnight. An increasing number of Czechs have got used to buying Christmas gifts online. British music legend Phil Collins will bring his Not Dead Yet live tour to Prague next year. The singer is to perform at Prague's O2 Arena on June the 25th. Tickets ranging from 2,000 to 4,000 crowns will go on sale at the end of November. Collins first performed live in Prague in 1997 and originally wound up his solo career in the Czech capital in 2005. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. Tuesday should be cloudy to overcast around most of the country, with day temperatures between minus 1 and plus 3 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarova, and that's the end of the news.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio. Coming up in today's programme, Czech MPs have called for tough moves against Russia following the clash with Ukraine. Czech purchasing power is rising with GDP growth. And later we'll talk to Barbara Day about a secret academic link set up between the Cambridge University and Czechoslovakia at the height of normalisation in the 1980s. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Czech MPs have called for tough measures against Russia after it opened fire on Ukrainian ships on Sunday. Members of the Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee advocate tougher sanctions, while there has also been talk of forcing a reduction in the relatively high staff numbers at Prague's Russian embassy. Ian Willoughby has more.
A dangerous new crisis erupted between Russia and Ukraine on Sunday, when Russian border patrol boats fired on and seized three Ukrainian naval ships. Moscow says it was not notified in advance of the ship's passage along the Kerch Strait. For its part, Kiev insists they followed international rules. NATO and other Western organisations have called on the two countries to show restraint. Jan Lipavsky is the deputy chair of the Chamber of Deputies Foreign Affairs and Defence Committees. Speaking on Czech Radio Plus on Monday, the Czech Pirate Party MP pointed the finger of blame directly at Moscow and called for a response.
The situation is very dangerous. It is necessary to identify it clearly as Russian aggression and a breach of international law. The conflict occurred in international waters, and the Russians had no right to block the Kerch Strait. Sanctions could be targeted against the individual members of the Russian leadership who are responsible. European leaders need to agree on this. I would regard it as one form of reprisal.
Jaroslav Bžoch of ANO is also a deputy chair of the Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee. He too backs more sanctions against Moscow, as well as advocating a cut in the relatively high number of staff at the Russian embassy in Prague.
Here in the Czech Republic, we have the highest number of Russian diplomats, in quotation marks. So I would start with gradually expelling them. The fact that 140 so-called diplomats are operating in our country is simply wrong.
The Czech BIS intelligence service earlier this year highlighted the number of employees at the Russian embassy in Prague as a potential security threat. The recently appointed Czech Minister of Foreign Affairs, Tomáš Petříček, has been outspoken about Russia in recent days, including calling the country dangerous to Czech and EU interests. Speaking on Czech TV on Sunday, he said Czech officials were already in the early stages of talks with Russia over reducing staff numbers at its diplomatic mission in Prague.
One issue is cutting the number of cars registered by the Russian embassy, which is very high. We can only guess what they are being used for. We may hold a discussion in future on reducing the number of diplomats, but above all, non-diplomatic staff at the Russian embassy. The number should correspond to the size of the Czech Republic.
Mr. Petříček said on Monday that Russia's actions in the Sea of Azov were just as unacceptable to Prague as the annexation of the Ukrainian territory of Crimea.
Ian Willoughby with that report. Now, the Czech economy has been outperforming its Central European neighbours and is set to reach something of a psychological milestone next year when GDP per capita is on track to reach 85% of the Eurozone average. In more tangible terms, though, the average Czech is enjoying greater purchasing power and confident they can always find work. Brian Kennedy has the details.
According to a new study on the purchasing power of 42 European countries, in terms of disposable income, the Czech Republic is only just above average, ranking number 23, or approximately one-third below the European-wide average in 2018. But among the former Eastern Bloc countries, the Czech Republic is ranked third overall, behind Slovenia and Estonia, having overtaken Slovakia and Lithuania this year. This all means that Czechs' purchasing power per capita also far exceeds those of other countries such as Poland and Hungary. Steady GDP growth is not the only factor behind Czechs' increasing purchasing power. It also stems from the Czech crown having strengthened against the euro since the central bank stopped its currency interventions last April. But with rising purchasing power also come rising prices, at least in some areas, notes Pavel Mikoška, vice president of the Czech Republic's Trade and Tourism Union.
Basically, this reflects the situation on the market.
where business owners and producers sense there is purchasing power, and so they can in one way or another offset their own costs. In the past, businesses had to compensate for the unfavorable exchange rate on imports. Now they sense that they can move in the other direction.
Adjusted for inflation, the average gross monthly salary in the Czech Republic increased by 6.2% year-on-year in the second quarter to just under 32,000 crowns. Meanwhile, the Czech employment rate is at its lowest in 22 years, at below 3%, and many, especially university graduates, have never had it so easy finding work. So says Richard Hindels, rector of the University of Economics in Prague.
In fact, we've reached the threshold of full employment. More or less anyone who wants to work can find employment. This is hardly a common occurrence, and the Czech Republic is perhaps best in this regard in Europe. But, of course, external conditions can greatly impact the Czech economy, which is small and greatly dependent upon developments in other countries and the price of raw materials.
External threats aside, many Czech consumers are less concerned these days about saving for a rainy day and so more willing to pay for quality, fast-moving consumer goods. But the picture is far less rosy for Czechs when it comes to what is typically the biggest purchase a person will make in their lifetime, that of a home. Property prices in the Czech Republic are the highest in the EU compared to wages, with the price of a small family flat exceeding 11 times the average annual income. That said, data released by the Ministry of Finance on Monday show the relative economic level of the Czech Republic could gradually reach 85% of the average of Eurozone countries in 2019, and Czechs' comparative purchasing power should rise from 66% now to 71% next year.
Brian Kennedy with that report. Just a reminder that you are listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. You may be surprised to hear that one of the events to mark the 100th anniversary of the foundation of Czechoslovakia was held at the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge University in Britain. On the 29th of October, a plaque was unveiled commemorating a secret academic link set up between the university and Czechoslovakia at the height of normalization in the 1980s. Czech and Slovak students who found themselves unable to go to university because they or their families were out of favour with the communist regime were given the opportunity to study secretly for a Cambridge University degree. Under cloak and dagger conditions, academics would travel to Prague to give lectures at underground seminars on such hot political topics as the early Christian Church or New Testament Greek. David Vaughan picks up the story.
The idea of putting up the commemorative plaque came from some of the former students who had taken part in the scheme, as a way of thanking the university and reminding the younger generation in both countries of the realities and surrealities of living in 1980s Czechoslovakia. At the height of normalisation in 1980, a group of British academics set up the Jan Hus Foundation to support the principles of independent education in Czechoslovakia. They had a network of underground contacts with their Czech and Slovak counterparts, many of whom had been sacked from their academic positions in the years after 1968. The secretary of the foundation at the time was Barbara Day, who spent her time coordinating the clandestine contacts between the two sides, trying to avoid the attention of the Czechoslovak secret police. Today, Barbara lives in Prague. I met her to talk about the secret seminars, and she began by telling me how it all started.
Many young people were unable to attend university because, under the regime, they and their families really had to be part of the system. Any independent thinking young people were simply not allowed to continue at university. And wanting to learn and wanting to study, they started getting together in small groups in homes. Nobody has any idea how many of these groups there were, but they studied together, and some of them were able to bring in teachers, professors who had similarly been thrown out of the universities. One of these was the very excellent teacher of Jewish studies, Milan Balaban, who at that time was washing pots in, I think, the Slovansky Dům in the kitchen there.
There was another problem, wasn't there, that there were the students who were going through these seminars, but they weren't actually able to get any kind of official university education.
No, at the time I was working with the Jan Hus Educational Foundation that was sending lecturers from Britain, secretly, of course, on tourist visas, to help with the seminars and to teach the young people and to take the latest books and literature. But the more our lecturers began to go there, the more they realised that there was a need for consistency, that there needed to be properly taught courses. And so they worked with the students on setting up courses that were the level of university courses. And this was how the idea came through that it was also necessary to enable these young people to take some qualification. Because without a qualification, what happens in society is that you don't get into position of being part of the continuity of education. And it's serious not only for the young people themselves, but for the whole of society. Because what was happening was that the young people who did go and take up university places were not the ones who thought independently and originally, which is why nowadays people are complaining about the education system. It's this break in continuity that under communism for two generations there were generally, especially in the humanities, people becoming qualified who were not the best people, who should not necessarily become leaders and the educators. Even the young people who attended the underground seminars, they were kept out of the universities after 1989 on the grounds that they'd had no qualifications.
So you had people who were doing these underground courses whose underground degrees, let's say, were never recognised.
Those who obtained the qualification, in fact, they are recognised now. And it was the students themselves who went ahead and made sure that that happened. But there were only six who actually took the qualification. There were more following the course. But the exams were very arduous, very difficult, especially if you had a manual job during the day. You were exhausted by the evening. You attended a very academic seminar, and then you were expected to write essays. And eventually, under very difficult, secret, clandestine circumstances, you had to write the exam.
And so the idea began with theology, but did it grow beyond that?
Well, our first subject was philosophy that we were originally teaching, and that was what we wanted to find a course for. But it was very difficult to find an institution in Britain that would agree to this.
And so you were looking around for a British university, a partner that would be willing to provide the framework for these degrees so that they would be recognised as a degree of that university.
Exactly. And most institutions simply didn't get the point. They didn't understand that these students had to study clandestinely, that they had to take the exams under code names, they couldn't take them under their own name, that if the secret police got any whiff of this, then the whole thing would be destroyed. And we searched several places. My colleague Roger Scruton was the most active in this, and he was using all his contacts in the universities. But eventually it was the Cambridge University Examinations Board that agreed to this with respect to one particular course, the Cambridge Diploma and Certificate in Religious Studies. And that was where it matched up with the students we knew about already in Prague, who had already been studying Jewish studies for some months or years.
And so they were actually ultimately able to qualify from Cambridge University?
They did ultimately qualify. All the examinations had to be spread out over several years because they were taking four subjects, Old Testament and New Testament studies, Judaism and the early church. They began studying in 1986. The first exams were in the summer of 1989. 1990, of course, these particular students were far too busy even to think of examinations, but they actually went on to complete all the exams and to get the qualification by 1992.
And what are these students doing now?
Well, several of them are retired. One sadly has died, but he was a very interesting person who was, we didn't know it at the time, but he was an underground priest. So after the Velvet Revolution, of course, he moved into his calling in the full way. Another one became very high up in the Ministry of the Interior, and the other was a security expert. One was a nuclear physicist. One was a conservation expert, and one became a diplomat and at one point deputy foreign minister.
You've talked about this lasting legacy of mediocrity in the universities, but at the same time, I think that what you were doing at that time is also an illustration of how something, even on a very small scale, just a few students, can make an impact in the long term. You have, I think, managed, since the fall of communism, to at least point to a certain set of values which are essential in order for higher education to work.
Yes, I think what happened with the underground seminars was that you got really down to the very heart of what education is about, that people had a need to learn, a need to study. I think all those people who went through long periods in the underground seminars, not only the Cambridge Diploma Seminar, but I was going to say there was one very important seminar in Brno. There were several very important seminars in Brno. But the people who attended those, when I meet them nowadays, they're people who are really aware of what is going on, who are open to change and have a sense of what really matters, what their values are in life.
And you've just come back from Cambridge, where you took part in an unveiling ceremony which remembers this work. Tell us more about that.
Yes, that was one of the students, Marta Kadimova, who suddenly came to me with this idea of what she wanted to do, that she felt that the lecturers who'd came, because they came in their own time, using their own money, and it was also quite dangerous for them to come, though not as dangerous as for the students here. But she felt that they hadn't been properly thanked. She wanted to leave a permanent record, and she had the idea of a plaque to be put up in Cambridge. And I approached my former colleague, Andrew Lennox Cunningham, who had organised all the Cambridge Diploma Seminars. He went to the Regius Professor of Divinity in Cambridge, who was amazed by the story, had never heard it before, and made everything possible for the plaque to be installed in the Faculty of Divinity. And so we all assembled there the day after the 28th of October. The date was chosen to coincide with the 100-year anniversary.
It was the foundation of Czechoslovakia.
Exactly. There were people from the foundation there. There was Marta, whose idea it was, Marta Kadimova, who brought her daughter, because she said that what really inspired her to do it was the realisation that many of her daughter's friends at school did not know about what had happened and the way people lived in the period under communism.
You mentioned that there's also this sense that the underground seminars enable people to focus on the fundamental importance of education, the deeper relevance of education in our lives. Do you think that you're going to be able to continue in the future with the Jan Hus Foundation to help this to continue as a thread in the Czech education system?
Well, I think the foundation that's now in Brno is doing that. It works not only in the universities, but in the secondary schools as well. There's an essay competition every year on the freedom of the word. And I know that Marta Kadymova is very happy with the installation of the plaque and the ceremony, but she also feels that we could go on and that there must be more ways of establishing what was really a very important action. I think at the time when we were doing it, we simply were getting on with something that had to be done. But in retrospect, it was meaningful.
And do you think that that role works both ways? It strikes me that at the moment there is an astonishing amount of ignorance in Britain about the realities of Central Europe.
People tend to think that once communism was over, everything turned round and changed totally, and attitudes changed, behaviour changed. But there are still a lot of complexes left, still a very strong mindset, even among people who, let's say, were on the right side of history. They still find it difficult to shake off the legacy of fear, of uncertainty, mistrust. What I fear is that there was too much done to say, let's put it behind us and let's forget about it. And you can't come to terms with something unless you remember it.
Barbara Day was David Vaughan's guest on that program. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for today here on Radio Prague. If you have any comments, then please send them to us. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook and Twitter. But that's all for now from me, Ruth Franková. Thank you very much for joining us, and goodbye.